You're listening to the Technology Whisperers, episode 5 of season 3, with your hosts Sean G. Mueller and Alistair Ross. Today, Sean, what have we got in store for everybody listening to the podcast?
I know that the people last week, we had a recast of a previous one from season 2. Obviously, our most popular episode ever, the Spicy Brain episode. This episode, we're going to do a current affairs. We haven't done one of these since about mid-season last season. As anybody that watches IT knows, there's a heck of a lot of stuff going on. So we're going to try and bring everybody up to speed, maybe do some demystification of some of the things that are happening so that people have a better understanding of what the ramifications are. Today is going to be about current affairs. So what's happening right now within the IT space? Now, you're going to hear a bunch of security stuff from us because there have been some massive security things happen. Microsoft, massive data loss. But you're also going to hear some AI stuff. We're going to have some conversations about the space within AI, because those seem to be the two big topics right now. That can change. We might touch a little bit of virtual reality. We might touch a little bit of application development. We'll go around, but we're going to talk current affairs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have prepped a few show notes for today's podcast, Sean. And as I was doing my research, I was unbiased in collecting the information. And literally everything that I was looking at was talking about those two things that everybody's heard to the ends, right? Cyber and AI. However, they do seem to dominate the landscape for a reason. And I think that people are asking slightly different questions than they were 6 months ago. And that's perhaps a good thing. So if you're not completely bored to your ends with both AI and cyber, now, Sean, obviously you work in AI and I work in cyber, so I guess it's near and dear to our hearts. However, you know, I think there's enough going on in that area that's happening all the time that it's worthwhile just keeping on top of that. Because if you're in a leadership position, if you're in an executive position, or if you're just somebody who's kind of wanting to know more about the current state of technology and us demystifying it for you, it's certainly worthwhile listening in. So let's go just jump it straight into it, Sean. This one here is, I've heard a couple of people talk about this now, and there's been a few podcasts I listened to recently, and there's a few people saying, is AI another dot-com bubble which is set to burst? Now, Sean, I think you're in an extremely good position to talk to this one. So what's your thoughts on this one?
There are a lot of similarities, right? There is a huge hype cycle around AI, and the valuation of AI companies, OpenAI is a perfect example, and NVIDIA, the most valuable company on the planet, NVIDIA right now, which is now considered an AI company. They make chips that do AI. There may be a little bit of a bubble. I don't think it's the level of the technology bubble burst that we saw in the early 2000s where, you know, 40% of the companies that had been created online are suddenly going to evaporate because they really didn't exist. But I do think that we're going to see some market shifts over the next 6 months. And the really weird thing is a couple of these companies that we might be calling overvalued today might actually end up being undervalued.
That's interesting.
The capability is massive. Everybody's talking about large language models. If you've listened to any of our episodes, you should know what a large language model is. But by the end of this year, companies like OpenAI are going to be releasing large action models, which are going to be models that do things under, you know, common conversational interactions.
Yeah. So I think the evolution of what AI provides us is, you know, we're really at a very, very early stage right now, right?
Correct.
And I think people saw a trajectory for the internet. Now, this is, we're talking here back in the early 90s, sort of pre-1994, so 20 years ago, right? 30 years ago even. So we had a trajectory of what people thought the internet was probably going to be in those days. And there is a trajectory even of what people think AI is going to do. And I think a lot of people are drawn to that dot-com bubble bursting. Yeah. I saw a really interesting commentary on The Guardian. I think that was on the 13th of April from a guy called John Naughton. And it is interesting, the various different alignments, I guess, that that have been made. Now, obviously, you get the different stages of a boom. So the first is displacement, and ChatGPT was the rationale that for the first displacement, and that happened in November of 22. Then there's a boom, and that's sort of already kicked off. And then there's the next stage of the cycle, which is euphoria. And that's the stage that they reckon in the Guardian's article that we're in. So caution has been thrown to the wind by ostensibly rational companies, and they're gambling colossal amounts of money. Now, Sam Altman, he claims he didn't say this, but I would say that there's enough evidence to say that he did say this. But Sam Altman, he said, he's the boss of OpenAI, just in case you don't know. He started talking about raising $7 trillion from Middle Eastern petrostates in a big push to get AGI, that's artificial general intelligence, to turn out to be a real thing quicker. Yeah,
the dollar amount was to build a chip company that would build AGI chips that could get us to AGI. The hesitation I would make, and I, by the way, I've read those articles that draws that dotted line between the dot-com bubble burst and where we're at. And I would say that the analogy, it's easy to see that analogy, but I like to draw a dotted line between the launch of the iPhone and what AI is doing. The launch of the iPhone was, from a technology perspective, was actually fairly underwhelming. It didn't really do that much, but it exploded. Never came back down. And the reason it didn't come back down is it iterated as a product. The dot-com bubble burst was, hey, I've started a website. I've got 10 subscribers, so I must be worth $5 million.
Yeah.
AI is closer to the iPhone analogy because let's use Salesforce as an example, right? So Salesforce is AI enabling every single one of their business practices. And as a business, so ignore the technology, as a business, they think it can increase their productivity by 30% within their business, let alone for their customer. That's a really very real business-driven number. Isn't about, you know, I have all these subscribers, and so suddenly that makes me worth $5 million. And so I think in a lot of ways that there is some truth to the euphoria, overspending, especially in companies that don't know what they're doing. But I think there are some very real lines that you can draw between that iPhone iterative, and as fast as going. MIT just recently released a paper where they have demonstrated that AI and large language models, it's acting at a level that is least human, just slightly better capable for certain tasks, like interpretation, alignment. There are a whole bunch of series for language interaction that it's achieving a human level equivalent capability. And that's something significantly different than pets.com, who said that they were potentially going to have 100 million customers in the next 6 months with no real business plan.
Yeah. And again, there's a lot of money that's not really going to go away anytime soon in this chip making stuff. And that's we've seen so much growth in NVIDIA, right?
Yeah.
NVIDIA is a massive, massive GPU chipset maker, but they've pivoted recently and they're not just doing graphics. They're now doing these chips for AI purposes as well. And so that's where a lot of stock value is going. So, you know, is this stage five then, if I listen to you, Sean, what you're saying is stage five panic is not a stage which is actually ahead of us. We're going to have some right sizing perhaps, because I think right now we're in this euphoric stage and it's just a money grab. There's a lot of organizations going, oh, we do AI. Which, and when you look under the skin, it's one of two things. One, it's an API connection to OpenAI.
Yeah, or a bunch of people.
Or a bunch of people. Or maybe a clever if this, then that kind of statement. But ultimately, what you're talking about here is you're saying, nah, I don't think so. I don't think this is a boom.
Yeah, I really believe that there are enough companies that are actively getting true value. Microsoft, all of the data coming out of Copilot and, you know, using Copilot to do development work and how much productivity gains is there. The reality is we've had a productivity problem in the world, plateaued the productivity. And in the last year, we've seen that now leap ahead almost 50%. to almost 100% because of AI.
Isn't that incredible? Like, we're actually, as a human race, we've gotten lazy. The productivity hasn't increased over the last few years, what you're saying. And now AI's come up to pick up that slack. That's a very detrimental statement about the state of beings, isn't it?
It is, but we've gone through this before, right? And one of the early, keep going back to the iPhone because there are so many good analogies. But when we began using iPhone as a more and more platform for the things that we no longer have Encyclopedia Britannica's at our house. We no longer print out Mapsco, have Mapsco maps in our glove compartment or go to Microsoft Maps and print out maps to get to places. Our notes are taken. You know, there are still people who carry written notes, but a lot of people are just doing text transcriptions now directly on their iPhone. So that, yes, there is a laziness factor to it. Completely agree with that. At the same time, the platform has allowed us to raise our level so that I don't have to do a rote memorization of everything. It's equivalent to in the 80s and 90s as maths classes transitioned from rote memorization of logarithmic tables to here's how you use a calculator to get logarithmic answers.
Mm. Yeah, that's an analogy that I really enjoy. I've used that a number of times. So yeah, awesome. All right, well, let's move on to our next thing. So I'll actually bring the next one to New Zealand and we'll go back to AI. I just don't want to get AI lash and we get bored of the thing before we've even ended the podcast. So I was very interested to look at the news and the media recently about what's happening with the cloud in our sovereign state of Aotearoa, New Zealand. Now, we had two companies announce, one after the other, a little bit of a lag, but the first company that announced that they were coming to New Zealand and providing us a sovereign cloud was Microsoft. Microsoft Azure, in this, I can't even remember which year it was now, but it was a while ago. It was like 2021.
It was 3 years ago and followed, and I don't remember. I have to go back and look at the dates, but AWS and Azure announced within, a month or two of each other, both of them saying that they were going to deploy a region in New Zealand.
Yeah, that's right. And both of them, it turned out to be Auckland based. So what, fast forward to at least 2 years from that, and the amount of actual operational regions which AWS and Azure have in New Zealand is a big fat zero. And with Azure still plodding ahead somewhere, we don't quite know where Microsoft have got to on that one, but AWS has actually placed the pause button on their data center here in Auckland. Now, that's really interesting. There's a whole bunch of reasons that it could be, but they've actually pretty much silently done this. They haven't actually made a press announcement about it or anything like that, but
there's been a handful of news articles about it that Amazon has had input into them. So demystifying, okay, let's take a step. I have built several multi-million-dollar data centers over my IT career, and 2 to 3 years to build a data center at this capability level is uncommon. In fact, 2 years to get the shell of the building and infrastructure in place to be able to support it is not the big deal. Big deal is that although they've broken ground, they haven't progressed any of that beyond breaking ground. So they're not a shell of a building. There's infrastructure pieces aren't in place. So the pause that they put on it is just pushing out that date for AWS.
Yeah. New Zealand. AWS are a long, long way away. That's for sure. Yeah. Azure probably a bit closer. But what has really interested me is that somebody said that enough is enough. We can't really wait. And that somebody's there's two somebodies involved from different parts of the equation. First of all, the DIA is having a look at what we should be doing with our data. And they're actually saying, hold on a minute, guys. We're very quick to rush into a cloud-first approach. And we really haven't considered enough of the sovereignty aspect. So the government has had this push for a long, long time to say, yep, cloud-first, cloud-native. And, that hasn't really always had the full effect of checks and balances on that one. So what's really interesting to me to find out is that the Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI, is coming to country. Now, I don't know if it would have fully have come to country were it not for a company called Team Cloud, who are a part of the Team IM company. So this is a fully hyperscaling cloud product. It's not like, you know, the what you could kind of call cloud, but not really cloud, like the likes of Rivera, CCL, Spark, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, it's not a managed hosted service. It is actually a hypercloud. There is another company that's done it for several years, Catalyst Cloud, that has data sovereign data centers in New Zealand, but they use other people's data centers to deploy their hyperscale capability. But yeah, this Oracle one is really interesting, Alistair, and I'm really looking forward to, you know, the next year or so as we hear about the detail about it. Because I think there are a lot of companies that still use Oracle on the back end for a lot of work.
So I chatted to Craig Hampson, who is the director of Team IM, Team Cloud there, and he's confirmed with me two pieces of useful information. One is that they will be going live from 1st August, and two, nice. That their pricing is supposed to be incredibly competitive and beat the pricing both of AWS and Azure. So looking
That's
forward
massive.
To seeing how that develops. That's pretty massive. Yeah. So, I mean, like there was a reason behind me saying this. It's quite exciting for New Zealand to actually be able to have a proper cloud that's both that and cost competitive. Because the other thing, we look at Sparks and CCL, whatever, and even Catalyst and Datacom as well. Let's not forget them. They're all pretty premium cost because it costs a lot of cash to get a data center like you were kind of alluding to earlier on.
The Azure and AWS were, the rumors that I was hearing was 20% increase on cost for deployment into the New Zealand region. So having
and is that above
competitor,
Australia or America?
Again, just rumors. I have never seen a pricing sheet from them or their expectation, but it's a question.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody actually has seen a full pricing sheet. I don't think they have actually released it yet. So it'd be interesting. What I do know is that their pricing based on American pricing from an OCI perspective is a marked change below that pricing. So
very nice.
Very interesting to see where it all comes out in the wash. Yeah. Okay. On to the next thing then. So we've had a talk, we had a podcast a few months back, I think it was, with regards to quantum cryptography or quantum computing actually. And we're in this world where there are some very specific case quantum computers out there, but we don't have general quantum computing. We talked a lot about that on the podcast.
Yeah.
However, we're in this world where we understand that quantum is coming, and that's a big deal because it's going to really change everything we do computationally right now. So, and I think a lot of people are kind of head in the sand. It's not here yet. So why do we even care? But it's coming, and it's not a long away. We don't exactly know how long, might be 5 years, might be 10 years, but it's soon. And the big problem with even now, because we do have single purpose quantum, and also we can have a store and forget until quantum kind of thing. So if we as a hacker manage to download some password hashes, for example, and we can't really easily decrypt those because we just don't have the computing power, right? To run a full attack on a password file hash that we've downloaded illegally or something, that takes a significant amount of time and computer time.
Especially if you're talking elliptic curve or anything that's 256 bit or higher in hashing. You're absolutely right, Alistair. It's very difficult. To your point, quantum computing, you could have a purpose-built quantum computing instance that could dehash or play those backwards into the passwords that they actually exist, which is
we're talking like seconds if not less to decrypt even fairly strong encryption standard passwords of today. So imagine if you stored them as a hacker and go, right, okay, I'm not going to be able to decrypt them now, but give it 5 years, I really care about these passwords, I'll just store that silently, nobody knows I've got them, and then I'll decrypt them with quantum later on. So what's happening is, and this is according to Liz Centoni, who is the executive VP of and GM of applications at Cisco, she says that post-quantum cryptography is going to be adopted by browsers, operating systems, and libraries, and innovators will experiment by integrating it into protocols such as SSL, TLS 1.3, which governs classic cryptography, such as when you use your web browser. So this post-quantum cryptography, what she's actually saying is that the world is going to adopt this cryptography standard, this capability of these new mathematical cryptography standards ahead of the world going to quantum computing. And it's going to happen this year or next year. What do you think about that?
So you're absolutely right. I think I read a TLDR of that article. I meant to go back and read the article. I haven't read the article yet. But she's right. It needs to be done. The question is whether or not companies are willing to invest the money in the changes. I mean, let's just take removing cookies from browsers, right? Chromium said 2 years ago that they were going to remove cookies from browsers because Google had said, we don't need cookies anymore. So, but that was 2 years ago, and we still have cookies today. And in fact, Chromium still supports them. Now, they're end of life as of the end of this year. So if you stay up with your updating your Chrome version, by the end of this year, your Chrome version won't support cookies anymore. That's 2 years on. So I think she's right. We have the technology. We have the software capability to do post-quantum cryptography. There's a cost associated with it. And as of yet, I haven't seen anybody, even at the VPN side, which Cisco is a massive VPN company. They sell VPN hardware. They sell VPN software. I haven't seen anybody announce when they're going to release post-quantum cryptography supporting software yet. I know there are little startup companies that have, but I mean, we're talking, you know, Google Chrome or Firefox or macOS or Microsoft. I haven't heard anybody put that on their roadmap, and I follow most of those blogs. So,
okay. So you reckon that she's talking.
Well, she may have knowledge that I don't have. She sits on I know she sits on quite a few advisory boards. And so she may be aware that and Alistair, you and I both know that if you were an OS, if you had a backlog of stuff to deliver for your OS, to update your OS, post-quantum cryptography was on that list, you wouldn't be telling.
Yeah, true. So look, it's probably going to happen before quantum computing hits the mainstream, I think is a fair thing to say.
I would agree with that, yeah.
The closer quantum computing gets to general purpose quantum, the harder keeping our stuff safe is going to be. And so we need to be ahead of that curve before it actually happens.
That's right.
So yeah, it's an important aspect.
The scary thing about this is, and you are aware of this as well, is that my Anna is still running, Windows 2000. So, I mean, it's great if the operating systems, it's great if the browsers, it's great if the applications of VPN, update their stuff so that it has post-quantum cryptography. But the reality is that the users that are out in the world that are at risk, if they don't maintain updates to their devices, to their software, and the hardware, it'd be great if the operating system supported post-quantum cryptography. But if it requires more powerful hardware to be able to do that, 80% of the public isn't going to help.
Yeah, that's right. The application of these mathematical equations is going to be quite interesting because the equations are here and now, but what does it actually take to execute them? And is it half done in the cloud? Is it done on client only? Who knows? Quite interesting. Yeah, okay, so let's move on. Let's take it from, a subject which is very close to privacy to actual privacy. So we're talking about encryption of your stuff to make it safe and private there. Now we'll talk about the Privacy Act here in New Zealand. So the Privacy Act was updated last in 2020, and it's called the New Zealand Privacy Act 2.0. It recently changed the Minister of Privacy Ombudsman, I should say, in, I think it was 2023, late 2023. And what he did is he had a look at where we're at with it and versus the rest of the world, and saw that New Zealand was, in terms of financial recourse, so far behind other country.
Yeah.
It wasn't even funny. And yeah, I think more privacy breaches.
Yeah, what was it? Yep. He did an interview where he said that businesses were actually saying it's cheaper for us to pay the fine than to go through the effort to actually report the privacy breach, which that's fairly telling.
Yeah. So Privacy Commissioner has basically looked at where we are compared to the rest of the world and just gone, hey, we need to do something about this. And it's interesting that, we're talking about an update to legislation within 5 years of it being announced that, the last update to the Privacy Act was many, many years. So it really is quite interesting there. But obviously shows how rapidly we are going through change there. So an interesting situation to be in.
Yeah, and I think they actually updated some of the language in it to talk about data used for training of machine learning models. So the Privacy Act actually was fairly well written from a stance of how to identify what is a privacy breach and the actions you should take from a privacy breach and all of the things that could be considered privacy breaches. Not very mature, not very aggressive from a penalties point of view, but at least the other portion. And I think they've done a good update with this one, that adding as technology have changed, I think they've done a really good job. They still have good recommendations on how to implement things and to implement notifications and reporting around it. I still think the penalties are fairly low. Again, businesses, especially private businesses, are going to make a choice about whether or not they enact the reporting capability, or they just pay the fines. We'll see.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, and I think Michael Webster, I mean, I saw him talk at the Cybersecurity Summit in March 24. And, you know, he said, look, there's, you know, we compare ourselves to every other country. Yes. New Zealand is by far the weakest in terms of developed countries that in that fine approach. So if they changed nothing else but just the fine, then it would be, you know, even better.
It'd be an improvement.
I agree with him in that regard. But he has a whole bunch of here and there that make things better, and AI is an aspect of that. So yeah, in terms of like where we are and the amount of privacy breaches, we are, you know, quite high in comparison to like other countries in the West. But we, you know, if we look at Australia, the fines can be millions of dollars. I think it's something crazy like $50 million fine, which, you know, if you look at everybody else, that's almost seems excessively high. So I don't think that we would end up being $50 million, but, you know, we probably need to get better than $10,000. I mean, that's a bit silly, really.
That's right. And they need to be cumulative, right? So if you have one privacy breach, one person impact, you know, whatever the dollar amount is, if I have 100 of them, the fine should be 100 times. If I have 10,000 breaches, similar to Copilot, just recently having a data breach that had a whole bunch of stuff.
My next topic.
Yeah, I knew it was. So if you have 10,000 breaches, then the fine should be the fine amount times 10,000. Then you start having companies having to seriously consider, oh, okay, if I have a privacy breach, I need to report it. I would rather report it than be fined for not. Maybe we should be clear about that. The fines we're talking about are not fines because you had a privacy breach. I think Alistair and I are fairly clear on the record that everybody's going to get hacked eventually. If you do anything on the internet, eventually someone's going to try and hack. And privacy breaches are going to happen. This is about not reporting the privacy breach. That's the fines we're talking about. So if you decide, it's not worth it for me to let everybody know that, you know, my privacy's been breached and my customer's data is out there, and I shouldn't let the commission know, and there should be a fine that tells you that that's wrong.
Totally. All right. Well, then that's perfect segue then to the next article, which is all about Microsoft and Copilot, and also it being a bad month in general for Microsoft in the security respect. So first of all, what is Copilot? Sean, do you want to tell people what they can get for about $300 per year from Microsoft, which is just out this month?
So Copilot was originally developed as a development assistant tool. It was backed by OpenAI, and it was a tool that would, you could say, hey, can you write a piece of code to do this? And it would give you a sample piece of code, and it would accelerate some of the work. Microsoft has been pivoting for the last 6 months, working on developing Copilot for general business. So Copilot being, hey, I need to create a PowerPoint on this. I write a letter, you know, in my email for this, I need to create a document that says this, using the data that you have stored in Microsoft OneDrive or that you have stored in Teams, it could help you write or generate whatever it is that you needed. The downside is that OpenAI and Microsoft, based on the way that they had originally implemented Copilot, it learned from the data that you use to interact with it. So if you took a giant spreadsheet and you said, hey, here's the spreadsheet that's all my business, my secret business work, secret business. Can you write a summary report in a Word document that says this? It would read through all of that Excel spreadsheet and it would write the document. And then it would use that data to help train itself so that it would do better the next time.
So it would also, if a lot of
fighter.
Yeah. So a lot of organizations or large businesses, I guess, use SharePoint, right? And SharePoint is used in conjunction with OneDrive, which is, you know, it's just a file, the Explorer view off SharePoint a lot of the time. Yeah. And Teams also
and
stores
Teams
all
well.
Its information in exactly. So all of this in the back end really is Microsoft SharePoint. So when you start going, okay, Copilot, have at it, go look at my SharePoint, it's suddenly got the keys to the kingdom and it can look at all of the information that your organization has, Word documents, spreadsheets, you know, databases, Teams chats, you name it, the whole shebang.
And wouldn't you know, people are doing bad. They're not doing secure business. They're putting usernames and passwords to stuff in clear text and storing in SharePoint. And CFOs are putting their login details for, you know, all of their accounts in Word documents and Excel spreadsheets that sit in SharePoint. Yeah,
totally. And this is the primarily, I put a thing up on my LinkedIn about this a couple of weeks ago, and most people did agree with the sentiment that people are lazy, right? Mm. So what happens with all of this stuff is great technology. It's really helpful because it's going to tell you, hey, can you tell me, you know, the names of the last 10 people that were employed or something like that? And you know, if that information is supposed to be seen by you, that's quite helpful because you might not know them personally. So, hey, great. Yeah. That's information that's come from HR's information over to you. And if you're allowed to see that information, why shouldn't you be able to call it up through Copilot? The problem is that human beings are lazy. And they forget to classify stuff. They forget to say, okay, this is sensitive and it should only be seen by X, Y, and Z. You know, it shouldn't be seen by some janitor in the closet down in the basement. It should only be seen by HR and a couple of people in finance or whatever. And so the problem is when you forget to set these contexts or forget to set the permissions, you are standing a chance of people finding stuff by accident, maliciously, or just nosiness. And the problem is there was one extreme example was, you know, show me the salary of, you know, all the people that you can find.
Well,
and
what was it 3 or 4 years ago, the New Zealand government budget got released by someone, left public switch turned on in an AWS bucket and prematurely dropped the New Zealand government budget into it in treasury. And suddenly it was publicly available in a news report. That's the laziness that we're talking about is that if you don't put the controls on, you shouldn't be using the tool. The tool is there to make it easier for you to do things. And that will make it easier for you to have these risks. And Copilot makes it easier for people to find those. I know that there are bad actors out there. I said a few minutes ago, the spider comes into the story. There are bad actors out there that are going into Copilot and saying, hey, what usernames and passwords can you see? And it's coming back with answers.
Mm, that's it. Yeah. It wants to be helpful. So it's doing its job. So, yeah. So there's, I think that Microsoft have been very, very active in this AI space, especially since they dumped a whole lot of cash onto OpenAI. They want to see a return for that investment. They want to be known as the first to market with Bing search with Copilot. They want to be first with Copilot to Office. They want to be first to everything here and really show that they're a market leader in that Gartner quadrant or whatever.
Yeah.
And I understand that. But the problem with being first is you can make mistakes. And I think there's already a few tells from the implementation that they've made here that they are making mistakes. And you have to be very, very careful. So my advice to you, before your organization switches on that Copilot, make sure you've classified all your data, make sure you're looking through the permissions, and hopefully you'll be all right. If you want to talk to somebody about all of these things, then by all means, get in touch with me at Revolution InfoSec.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a little bit of a pivot here, right? So OpenAI has released an OpenAI for Business or enterprise version of OpenAI, and it has a switch on it that says, yes, you can use your documents and you can use your SharePoint stuff, but don't use any of that data to train the model.
Yeah.
So you can choose So, and what we're starting to see, Anthropic has done the same thing. Gemini is now, GCP Gemini has the same capability. You can use the large language models to get the value out of them and tell the model to learn from what you do. But it's equivalent to you going to Google and saying, hey, how many people are searching for Coca-Cola and I work for Pepsi? Google can sell you that data. They can sell you the data, but ideally what you want is you want them to obfuscate it so that they can't tell you how many people are buying Coca-Cola, but maybe how many people are you know, searching for sodas or are buying sodas through the interfaces. And then I can take that data and use that data to sell Pepsi. We need the data extrapolated or obfuscated enough that we can't use it to actually do harm to other companies that are potentially competitors.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, really quite interesting to see where that one's going to go. Just a footnote, I really wanted to talk about it a bit more, but in the interests of keeping on, Microsoft did get hacked. I think it was last month now, and that story is continuing to evolve. The hacking group was called Nobelium, and they've come out and said we're responsible. I think they're Russian, and they were behind big breaches in the past, like SolarWinds.
Russian government-sponsored. Yeah.
Right. And, okay. So.
And it includes U.S. data, U.S. government data in that.
Yeah. So this is a constantly evolving story. It gets worse and worse for Microsoft. But basically, yeah, Russian hackers that are state-owned got into Microsoft's corporate systems and have stolen some amount of data. And Microsoft tried to bury this one on a Friday evening when it first came out, and they said, nah, they've not got any data. And then it turned out that they did have data, but they said it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't that important. And now they're saying maybe it is important. So yeah, it's not looking good for Microsoft at the moment. So, you know, some people are going as far as to say that Microsoft don't and have never taken security seriously enough, because it's like, it's something that could impact their bottom line. So again, there's more of a conversation on that one, but it's certainly an interesting footnote on the matter of Copilot. Okay, so on to the next news item, which I think is worthy of discussion. Social engineering, so into a little bit more cybersecurity side of things. Social engineering and deepfakes are continuing to rise. Now, I did have some statistics on this, but it's according to CrowdStrike's Turedi, identity-based attacks are continuing to be the main weapon for threat actors this year, and for the simple reason that it continues to be a very fruitful method. So if you're seeing more and more tailored attacks in your inbox, that's why. Now, it's stated here, as revealed in CrowdStrike's latest threat hunting report, 80% of breaches occur through compromised identities. So that's basically when somebody has been hacked by a serious event, or maybe a less than serious event, but either way, it's pretty important. But what happens is that once somebody that you know has been attacked and has got compromised, they can then send spams out to people that a compromised account know, and they look, because they're coming from somebody that they know, they are legit.
Yeah.
So you trust them a lot more. So adversaries are not relying solely on compromised valid credentials either. Rather, they abuse all forms of identification and authorization, including weak credentials purchases from underground. You can get purchases from the dark web, I believe, for as little as $5 for New Zealand-based credentials. So this is, if you think this is something that's going on in the States or some other country, nah, forget it. This is just here in New Zealand as well. It's local as anything. So yeah, this whole thing is you know, it was 79% or something of all attacks last year. It's now into the 80s. It's just going to keep on growing and growing and growing. So certainly keep looking at that inbox. It's not good. This is not a problem that we can all fix tomorrow. Just make sure that you're keeping savvy with regards to social engineering. And I should also, again, probably add a little footnote to this to say that deepfakes are something that is only on the rise as well. So not only do we have, you know, emails in the inbox looking really effective, they look like, you know, they're from somebody or an organization that you trust, they're written by AI, and so there's no spelling mistakes, there's no Nigerian princes anymore, this is like stuff from IRD or a Kiwi bank or whatever, it looks totally legit, you'd never know.
Or a text message or a phone call.
Or text messages.
Yeah. There's this new one that just came out is that you get a phone call from an unknown number and you begin talking to them and it sounds like you're talking to a real person and it's a fully AI generated deep fake asking for your information.
Isn't that crazy? So yeah. And so if we've seen the likes of Sora from OpenAI that can create very, you know, realistic images. So if we extrapolate that just by another year or so, we're going to be seeing, you know, Zoom calls with completely fake individuals that are just mapped on the real individual.
We've already seen one. So we saw a deep fake.
That's happened already.
3 months ago, an accountant got a call from a video call from the CFO and the CEO telling him to transfer $10 million into this. He's on a video call with them. He could see them, talk with them. Must be true. Transfers the money. All completely deep fake. Yeah.
So that is a startling example, but it's not really been happening a lot. What I expect to be happening is that's going to happen tons in the next year or two as the technology really matures. So yeah, watch out for that one. That's a kind of, cornerstone area of cybersecurity, which is really evolving both on the defense and the offensive side. Now, again, I'd hate to circle back to AI, but talking about green computing. Now, green computing or just the act of carbon footprint is something that is continuing to grow and grow and grow. At the executive level, a lot of organizations are really starting to think, right, we've got to really put our time and our effort behind ensuring that our carbon footprint is reduced because we want to go carbon zero, because there's emissions taxes. But whatever the reasons are that you have as an organization for reducing your carbon emissions, there is a growing concern about AI, because if we look at what's powering the AI, it's all these GPUs from NVIDIA. Yeah. It's all this very hot computing, which is
using a lot of power,
right? Yeah. So the more power, the more carbon emissions. And so where are we at with that, Sean? What do you think the answer to that is?
Well, so there's not going to be a magic bullet for this. I mean, the reality is that it's going to cost. I give you a Google look. Some of the Google data centers are now, they're using AI to push those Google data centers to zero emissions. So it is possible, but it's going to take the willpower of the people running those data centers to decide to do what is necessary to do. I mean, we're never going to do an environmental episode. As far as you know, is the environment changing? Is it warming? Alistair and I are never going to go down that rabbit hole. But the reality is it is getting warmer on a year-by-year basis. We keep hitting record heat. And that's only going to get worse. And the data requirements are going to fundamentally, or the AI requirements are going to fundamentally need a different type of compute. NVIDIA, Intel, and AMD are all looking at coming out with compute chips that don't use as much power or don't use as much heat. All three of them have announced that they have roadmaps to do that. Timeframes, and look, for-profit companies, and if there's no profit in doing it, I wouldn't expect to see anything very quickly. But Alistair, you're absolutely right. The AI that we're deploying is accelerating at a rate much greater than what we're doing to reduce the amount of carbon needed to be generated into the atmosphere from cooling and from power usage from the data center. So right now we're losing ground. We're not gaining ground using AI.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, part of the answer will come from sustainable energy, and New Zealand is well placed. But if you look at these data centers, you look at where AWS was going to build, my understanding is I do not believe that they were going to use any form of sustainable energy. So it makes you wonder why they're building data centers that don't utilize forms of sustainable energy when even they are available on your back door. Very interesting thought processes there. I don't quite know the answer. Obviously, I'm not privy to that, and AWS keep everything around these processes secret. But yeah, just a really interesting thing there. Okay, let's move on. Got a couple more things. I think one or two more. So this one is a story that kind of warms my heart a little bit. So there's a cybersecurity issue that happened last week or the week before. Now I think it was probably the week before.
Yeah, it was the week.
Yeah. Before. So basically there was an issue with a library. So I'm a big open source proponent, always have been. You know, I've been in open source since the 90s, really. And the internet, really, as we know it, a lot of people think it's this high-tech thing that's, you know, got tons of resiliency up the wazoo. But realistically, when it comes down to it, most of the internet is powered by open sources. You know, the web servers out there are things called Apache or Nginx. They run with hundreds of thousands of different little pieces of software. And these pieces of software are just, you know, hundreds of kilobytes in size. Maybe there's a megabyte in size. And they all have a specific task, but they're very small usually. And they're maintained often by volunteers, right? It's not just a, you know, a single sort of big corporate company running the whole show. No, it's a lot of little small people. So sometimes the volunteers, it might be a team of three or four, or it might be, you know, just one person in the back room somewhere. And, you know, there's got some pretty pivotal examples of this. I found out the other day that the TZ data package in Linux, which basically sets the time zones. And if you think about it, that information in there, all the systems that underpin things like the stock market, right? If the stock market goes off by even a second, then
clock sync
is bad. Clock sync, you name it. It's really bad, bad, bad days, like the end of world sort of stuff for the stock market, right? So that has to be updated all the time with new time zone data. And sometimes the time zones change with only a day or two's piece of notice. And the people who are updating that particular TZ data package, for example, there's only three people and none of them are paid for it. And no corporate funding. And yet this package underpins enterprise grade systems, which are worth millions or even billions of dollars. So incredible to think of that. But this particular piece of software is called XZ and it's like zip, you know, the zip compression. Well, this one's called XZ. It's another type of compression, which is better compression than zip. And some guy in America, I think it was Nebraska or something like that, noticed, you know, a couple of weeks ago that it was taking longer to run than usual, wondered why this was, and only for the fact that he was on holiday and had a little bit of spare time, he thought he would look at the source code. So he was one of these contributors to this XZ software. So looked at the source code and went and found that somebody had put a backdoor into it. And so that backdoor, so the problem with XZ is that's just a very small utility, a very small library, and it's also incorporated in other software. And one pivotal piece of software that it is included into is something called OpenSSH. OpenSSH is free software which allows us to remotely connect to things like Linux servers. And as we know, Linux powers about 60 to 70% of the internet. So if you're remotely accessing your Linux servers via SSH, which I and millions of other people do, and you were using the latest version of XZ. So this is a patched new version of XZ, completely legit. For the eyes of the exterior that now had a backdoor that could allow this bad actor to get into your server or millions of other servers,
or firewalls or routers or...
Yeah, massive amount of network infrastructure. Internet of things like, you know, sensors, you know, all sorts of things, like it just millions and millions of devices. My mind boggles. So if it wasn't for this one guy in Nebraska noticing that it was a bit slow, right, and finding out about this thing before it spread, literally the time difference between him finding it out and actually being in the wild was about a week. But if he had just not gone on holiday or something like that, if he just had, you know, didn't bother checking it, imagine. That would have spread not just from the Linux distribution which it was in, which is called Fedora by Red Hat. It would have gone into all of the other Linux distributions. Eventually, over time, everybody would have updated their Linux. And hey, guess what? Now you've got a unified backdoor across the whole freaking world. And it would have been a really bad situation.
Yeah, that's like the holy grail for a hacker, right? Is that they know they put this back door in and it's everywhere and they know it's there and nobody else knows it. Alistair, you're absolutely, I mean, I've contributed to open source projects. You've contributed to open source projects and it's a thankless job. Hmm. You put a lot of work and effort into it because you like solving problems. But at the end of the day, nobody even recognizes that you did it.
That's right. And so what happened is this particular person had been contributing legitimately to XZ for potentially years. And it had just gone unnoticed. So it done, you know, and I think either got bored or I decided to, you know, be malicious, or maybe their intent was malice all along and they just decided to eventually put this bit of bad code in at the end and thought that it would go unnoticed because they'd been committing code. But this is the problem here. We're underpinning the internet and many devices on it with code from volunteers that are not supported in any way and are not cross-checked. And that's the world that we're living in. And
it's kind of the upside downside to that open source software. And maybe we need to do an open source software episode, because I think a lot of people don't understand this, that on one aspect, if you get a very large group of people that, like kernel for Linux when it was originally developed, massive number of people that were working on it as it rolled out, really fast changes, really fast improvements, people respond to bugs. On the flip side of that, if you have very small packages that there's like two or three people working on, like when I worked on Base, which was the ACID fork.
A cybersecurity
thing. There was like four of us. And, you know, if somebody that's using it is like, hey guys, can you help me with something? We'd be like, we have day jobs. We might be able to get to that in like 6 months. And it could be a big thing. And because AI, close to my heart, the push now is open AI, or open, truly open developed machine learning models, large language models, truly open developed AI. And it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be hard. This is not something that's going to be easy.
Yeah. And I think if you are interested in listening into a podcast around what open source looks like today and what all the crazy things are about Linux and so forth, in a generally non-technical fashion, if that sounds like it would be interesting to you, why not hit us up and let us know? Because two of us here had lots of involvement with open source and that sort of stuff over the years, and it is certainly a topic that's near and dear to both of our hearts. So yeah, let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. And Alistair, I think we're heading up to time.
Here we are. Yeah,
I know you have one more.
Yeah, I think we've run out of time for that topic, unfortunately. That's okay. This time.
Let's plan on doing another current event a month or two, because I know current events they'll be all new and all things off. But why don't you go ahead and close us off, Alistair?
Yeah. Okay. Well, before I close us off, I'll ask, how can people get to you, Sean, if they want to talk to you and ask you? In fact, if they wanted to tell you that they did want open source topic in a podcast, how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah. So that's a good question, Alistair. And I will say, in the month I've presented at two different conferences, and now people are coming up to me and talking to me about the Technology Whisperers. If you see me at a conference, if you see me at work and you happen to listen, don't hesitate to talk to me. And I'm always willing to talk about the Technology Whisperers and love to get feedback about everything. But if you want to find me online, Sean G. Muller, CanGMuller, on all of the different social media platforms, or you can just Muller at techyleader.co.nz. And Alistair, awesome. how can people reach you, or how can people engage with Revolution InfoSec if they have some security problems?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you just want to email me, the easiest way there is Alistair, that's Alistair, like the stair that you walk up, Ali Stair. I've said that a few times now to mixed responses. So yes, Alistair@revolutioninfosec.com. You can check out the website, revolutioninfosec.com. And of course, you can hit me up on YouTube. I've got a YouTube channel there, and I've got a Twitter as well, and of course, LinkedIn
X.
So yeah, check me out. Of course, my personal LinkedIn as well is LinkedIn, search for Alistair Ross. Thank you very much for listening in to the podcast. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. But until then, take care. Thanks very much for listening, and be safe.